Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Broadway actor, musician, and writer Andy Miantis has just written his debut novel, The Backstagers and The Ghostlight, the first book in a new middle grade series based on the award-winning graphic novels. Heartfelt and featuring an inclusive cast of characters, The Backstagers series follows a band of theater misfits as they go on paranormal, action-packed adventures. Andy Miantis is best known for starring in the Broadway musical Spring Awakening, Les Miserables, and Wicked, as well as on television in the NBC musical drama Smash, and as Hartley Rathaway, a.k.a. the Pied Piper, in the CW series The Flash. Again, the new book is The Backstagers and The Ghostlight. It is a pleasure to welcome Andy Miantis to this week's book show. How are you?
I'm well, Joe. How are you?
I'm fine. It's very nice to have you on the program.
Thank you very much.
So tell us a little bit about the backstory of The Backstagers. This is something that was conceived in comicdom, and then you become part of it. How?
It's a super strange and long story, and so I'm glad to be able to tell it. Maybe a year and a half ago, I was in, a valley as an actor. I was waiting for the next gig to come along. I sort of flippantly one day tweeted something about maybe I ought to write a YA book, because it was something that interested me, but I was just sort of feeling like, what else could I do other than acting? Because when it's good, it's good, and when it's bad, it's really bad. And a friend of mine saw this tweet, and his friend was Maggie Lerman at Abrams Books. He wrote me and said, hey, are you serious about this? Would you like to meet Maggie and have just sort of a general? And I said, of course, because you just learn to say yes to things when you're, you know, an artist. And so I had never written any prose before. I had written some scripts, and I had a musical being produced at the American Repertory Theater that fall. So I had like a draft of that ready to go. And so I went and sat down with her, and we just sort of chatted. She gave me some samples, and I sent her my scripts, and she read them and liked them and wrote me back and, you know, gave me sort of thoughts and said, you know, if you ever decide to write something in the YA space, in the middle grade space, whatever, send us a manuscript as soon as, you know, you have enough written that you feel like you have a sense of the story and your voice as a writer, and we'll start to look at it and see if it's something we might want to do. And so, of course, I didn't do that. I got an acting job at long last and got busy with that. And it was something in the back of my mind, but it's just, you know, it's a lot of work to like sit down and write a book if it's not something that you do. And so then Maggie came back to me several months later with this project. They have a partnership with Boom Comics, which was the publisher of the Backstagers graphic novels. They had done a series based on another Boom series called Lumberjanes that they had crossed over into middle grade books with some success. And so they were looking to do Backstagers next. And something about my writing and my background in the theater told them I might be the right fit for this. So I took a look at the graphic novels. I immediately fell in love with the world and the characters. And I thought it might be a great way to get started in this world that's always interested me. And here I am.
So tell us a little bit about the world as the world that they created, in the sense that the Backstagers are this group of people who work behind the curtain, and they're a tight group, and it's at a boys' school.
Yes, it's at St. Genesius School for Boys, and they are the backstage crew of the Genesius Drama Club, and I loved a few things about it on first glance. I loved that it was a story about theater, but about a backstage crew, because I remember being interested in theater as a kid, but looking at the idea of trying to make a living in acting and just finding that totally terrifying. I still find it terrifying today. but it sort of didn't occur to me that there are all these ways to make a living in theater that do not involve you being on stage in a spotlight, that there are many, you know, deeply rewarding and exciting careers, and that being on the stage crew could be one of them. So I thought that was just awesome, because I feel like there are so many stories about kids wanting to be stars, but not that many stories about kids wanting to be a part of the theater, not necessarily the star of the show. And I loved, as you mentioned, it was a really inclusive cast. I thought it was a cast that any kid could see themselves in one way or another, but all of the stories focused on like adventure and fighting, you know, mysterious creatures and solving mysteries, not about the things that might make them different. You know, the things that make them different are just a part of who they are, and they're unapologetically who they are, but it doesn't create any drama in this world.
They're very accepted within their group and in the school and in this environment of the theater.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important step in inclusion. We're having these conversations about inclusion right now, and well, I think it's really important to tell the hard stories. It's also important to tell stories that just feature characters who may not have been featured in times past doing normal things that don't have anything to do with their identity or, you know, the color of their skin or things like that.
And what I like about it is that you don't beat us over the head with it. It just is what it is, which is different than many of those characters that we read where they're making a point of what that character is.
Totally. And I really have to credit the original creators, Ryan Tsai and James Tynion, with that, the creators of the graphic novel, because that tone and that approach to these characters is crystal clear from like page one. And I just thought that was something I really had to continue.
When it comes to this idea of the world of theater, I'm just making it very rich for you as a writer. I would think that given your background, as you mentioned, that you would say, oh, wow, there's a lot to play with here.
Absolutely. So delving further into the world of the backstagers that the original comics created, when they go backstage, when they cross that threshold of the stage door, the world back there where everything comes from, all the tools that they use or all, you know, the lights they need to hang, anything, is this sort of fantastical Narnia, Willy Wonka world where anything can happen, this magical realm that we say it's where the thing that makes theater magical comes from this hub of magic. And the original creators had created all this really fantastic lore around that. Me being from the theater as an actor, I know a great deal of real life theater lore. And so I wanted to see where those two things could like mash up and what would happen, which is why book one is about a ghost light, which is one of my favorite pieces of theater lore. I have a tattoo of a ghost light, which is a device that very practically you leave on all night. It's the last light left on in a theater when everyone packs up and goes home. And practically, it keeps people from falling into the pit. it provides a little bit of light in case someone is wandering across the stage. But, you know, mythically, it keeps ghosts from moving in to your theater.
There's a beautiful part of the book toward the end where you're writing about this as sort of all things come together. And they're in this space of backstage of this old venerable theater that is sort of the hub of all, sort of the theater gods of where everything is created and comes from. And it struck me in reading it that you get a sense of you get a feeling that you would, as an actor or even as a backstager, would get that feeling in working on a show no matter where you are.
Yeah. I mean, theater is haunted in a way, like theater the concept, because you just can't help but think about how many people have like said these words before you or how many people have stood on the stage before you. This dressing room that you think of as yours, that you decorate with all your little trinkets and, you know, you build your own little altar around your getting ready station. How many other people have thought that that was their space before? How many other people have inhabited that space? So I love that bit about the arc theater. It's called the archetypal theater because... yeah, when you're on a stage, you're on the concept of a stage as well, and that's like a really potent thing, I think.
So you're just starting the tour, so I'm sure you're going to be asked this question 5 million times. So let me be one of the first to ask it. Although you've probably been asked it a million times before too. But so, which character do you most identify with? Is there a character in here that you say, "Oh, okay, this is sort of my alter ego"?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely see myself inside of all of them. I sort of had to write them, but I think my like answer today is Jory, who's more or less the protagonist.
Yeah, for another show, give somebody else another answer.
Yeah, it's great. We'll mix them up. No, but Jory is the new kid. He's the fish out of water. He's the reader's eyes sort of into this world. You're learning about the world at the same time that he is.
Right.
And as someone writing my first novel, I am the new kid. I am, you know, learning as I go. And I just really love the way that Jory will sort of like blindly go in the direction that his heart leads him, and that gets him into trouble a few times in this novel and throughout the series. But he's always like learning a lesson. And I feel like I'm sort of the same way. I go boldly and sometimes that's a mistake, but I really try to pick up the pieces and learn from that mistake. And I think Jory does the same.
And he seems to usually do the right thing though, and has a good compass. He has a boyfriend here who they come to terms with the nature of the relationship and what that can be. And ultimately it works out.
Yeah. Yeah. Things turn out well for Jory this time.
This time.
Well, I mean, who knows?
When you think of this character in this group, talk a little bit about the idea that of this book attracting to theater kids, because that seems to me, as an outsider looking in, as a very much an untapped market.
Yeah, and it's a hugely devoted and loyal market. I was at a musical last night called Be More Chill that's playing off Broadway that is now going to Broadway, all because of this rabid fan base that it developed online after its first like out-of-town production, followed by these very young theater kids that see themselves in this story and have latched onto it and made it a phenomenon without sort of the interest of really any like adults or the kind of audience that theaters normally go after. And now this show is going to Broadway. So it is a hugely loyal audience. And so I hope I do them proud and give them something they like. And I wanted to write something that I wish I had, you know, when I was growing up, like in terms of the inclusion of the characters, but also just like something celebrating this thing that I always thought of as being very niche, but later in life I learned was actually pretty universal, you know, the love of the theater, but from a different angle, from an angle that kids might not consider. I also think it's useful because these are the backstagers, the kids sort of in the corner at the cast party, lurking in the shadows, not getting the spotlight. And I think a lot of kids find theater because in the larger high school life that they're leading, they are the kid in the corner. So they find the other kids in the corner and then they put on a play. And that's sort of what this story is.
It is that story. And also they're wearing black because of the work that they do. And so, yes, they are in the shadows and they meld very well in that world. The idea of the other thing that I find interesting, though, is, as you alluded to, that within that niche, you also have the backstagers versus the onstagers. So it's an interesting look because we think of, well, the theater kids is one group of kids. But then even with that, there's a subset of the kids who are on stage and the kids are back behind the curtain.
Yeah, I think we as humans try to find hierarchies wherever we are. Even if we're all the outcasts, you tend to like find out who are the most outcast of the outcasts, which is a terrible thing. And I hope to address that in this series.
Well, you do. And one of the things that also struck me is these kids are doing incredibly brave things. And one of the characters says it towards the end of the book is like, we've done all this stuff and nobody knows it. And it's much like their work as a backstager.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the allegory of the whole thing, right? That these are the people literally making the magic, literally saving the day, and no one ever knows because they're backstage. And some of the actors don't even know. I've definitely encountered that attitude toward the crew throughout my career. And it's really ridiculous, actually, when you think about how much responsibility are in the hands of those very talented people that work behind the scenes. They actually make everything go. And if they mess up your spotlight, you're not in the spotlight. And then who cares what you're doing in your performance because no one can see it. I think like the whole story is this great allegory for paying attention and honor to the people, not even in the theater, just the people that make the wheels turn of this world without being celebrated.
Andy Mantis is our guest. The name of the book is The Backstagers and the Ghostlight. Cool thing about this is that you sign a contract and this is book one, so you automatically know you're already doing another one.
Yeah, which was really scary because I had not written one and now I was tasked with writing two. And especially with this audience, this intended audience of middle grade, I decided early on that I thought that it ought to be pretty plot driven. Like it's not the kind of thing where you can take long deep dives into characters' psyches. I think it needs to be kind of twisty, turny, action-packed, exciting. And that's hard to do, like plotting. My favorite kinds of plays are the kind of plays where nothing happens, where, you know, someone sort of thinks about their life for 3 hours on stage in real time. This couldn't be that. So I found it way more challenging to decide what happens, and deciding what happens within the framework of this world that was handed to me, than it was to actually iterate, like, the, you know, the word count that I needed to hit in terms of actually, like, writing the prose. The outline was harder than the prose.
The outline of figuring out where all this is going to go.
Yeah.
And then you don't have to work with the original creators on that. Then that's all on you to come up with a story, because there's already a story that's taken place that you are really writing the rest of.
Yeah. So I decided, you know, back when this was brought to me, it was pretty open-ended about what these books could be. And so in reading the original graphic novels and having some conversations with people at Boom Comics, I decided that I wanted to make them sequels, not prequels, not sort of standalone side stories. I've tried my hardest to make this standalone, so if you are starting the series here, you won't be totally lost, but it's definitely what happens next if you're a fan of the graphic novels, or if you go back and read those. This is the next chapter in this larger story, and I try to bring a lot of things from that original story into this. And so for the first book, I sent all, you know, when I finally had the outline that I was comfortable with, I sent it ahead to Boom Comics and to the original creators for their notes and their thoughts. You know, if these seemed like the kids that they knew, and if things made sense sort of dramaturgically, if I had missed any major detail that broke the world canonically from the original comics, and got some feedback from them, which was really informative and helpful. And for book two, I sent the outline and got zero thoughts, which was really exciting. So I think now I get it. You know, now I'm really an expert on this world.
When it comes to the characters, who they are, their sexuality, I have a little knowledge of the comics. I've read some of them, not all of them. But it seems to be a bit more overt in the comics than it is in the book. Was that something that you decided to do, or that you were asked to do?
I think I really just wanted the things that identify these characters, you know, their sexual identity, their gender identity, what have you, to be just like effortless and just a part of who they are and really not the focus. So it felt really incorrect to like draw any major attention to it. Like it definitely wasn't a consideration in terms of the age group or anything like that, to
right,
like tone anything down. But, you know, they're fighting a ghost. They're not coming out to their parents.
So, no, they're not coming out to their parents, but there are relationships here. And is there a sense of, okay, well, we can further this in other volumes?
I just don't think that that's really what this series wants to be. You know, like there's a romance in book one, which continues throughout the series, between Beckett, who used to go to the girls' school, Penitent Angels, now has transferred to St. Genesius because he's in fact trans. And he has a major crush on the coolest girl in the world, Bailey Brentwood is her name, and she is the star actor who goes to Penitent Angels. So they were friends before when they were classmates, and now she comes over to St. Genesius to do the female leads in their shows. And so I considered, you know, maybe that plot line would be a good opportunity to sort of talk about like trans identities and consider how Bailey saw Beckett and, you know, this identity. But it just felt really like dead naming him in some way and unnecessary. Like really what the story is a person who has a close friendship and is wondering if that friendship is more than a friendship, and the fear of messing that friendship up if they take a step and test the waters, which is more universal.
Ooh, yeah.
And so his gender identity actually isn't relevant. It felt insensitive to draw extra attention to it because Bailey, the character, the object of his affection, wouldn't think about it. And so neither should we.
So with that said, I find this also interesting because you, as a bisexual, have talked about this a lot. So you have a forum if you want it, and then yet you don't want to have it overcome what you're writing.
Yeah, because I think anybody who's marginalized in any way will tell you that it's a major part of their story, but it's not their only story.
Right.
You know, my friend Shoshana Stern, who's this great deaf actress and writer, has this show This Close on, and it's on AMC, I believe. And it's not about how, you know, hard it is to be deaf in a hearing world. That definitely, like, factors into the stories. It can't help but factor in. But, it, you know, deaf people have tons of things going on other than just being deaf. They have relationships, and they have to pay their bills, and, you know, they have a work life. And we've already told the stories about how hard it is to be marginalized, and there are definitely still stories to tell. And if that's the story that creators want to tell, they absolutely should, especially if it's their story. But I think it's really necessary to have inclusion when that is not the focus. To me, that's actual inclusion, because when you walk around the streets of New York, you see every kind of person, but they're not all running up to you and telling you who they are and why they are who they are. They're just trying to, like, buy a bagel.
They're just trying to buy a bagel, for God's sakes. When you mentioned deaf, so the Deaf West production of Spring Awakening, you were a part of that. My God, was that a beautiful piece of work.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah. What was that like?
It was incredible. I mean, it was the most profound theater experience of my life for so many reasons. I mean, number one, the like working with and around deaf people for the first time in my life just opened my eyes to so many things that I didn't know about that experience, about the politics within that world. It was just truly eye-opening. We are so ignorant to this huge culture that exists all around us. You know, ASL is the only like American language there is, and yet nobody uses it other than the deaf or, you know, some strong allies. So that really changed things. And then also, you know, me and my husband created that production in a weird loft in the Arts District in Los Angeles, just as like something to do. And then it was at a 99-seat theater on Skid Row. And then it transferred to a larger theater in Beverly Hills. And then it went to Broadway. And, you know, I think a lot of people outside of Broadway think of Broadway as this sort of like big shadow organization that decides what it's going to program, as if it was like a regional theater. Like, oh, they're doing a revival of Kiss Me, Kate this year. They're doing The Band's Visit. Like, who's they? The answer is they is like no one and everyone at the same time. And so, you know, I always thought there were these systems in place, this major like bureaucracy that decided what happened on Broadway and why. And we were like the Muppets doing a show on Broadway. Like, it was just this totally handmade, homemade, you know, all of our friends in the cast, like, thing that just happened, and people liked it. And that was so, it's what I always dreamed of, honestly. It's the way it ought to be, and so rarely is.
And what a beautiful way also to do a revival of a cool work.
Yeah, yeah, and a work that I had done in its original production.
Right.
So I, to look at something from both sides that way was singular. It was crazy.
Just to go a little bit further on what you were just saying about this, you think of this under of what Broadway is. It is interesting, though, because you think you see a lot of shows off Broadway, you see a lot of shows out of town, you see a lot of great work that's done that you'll never see again. And you wonder, well, how could that possibly be? Because this thing is amazing. And then you go to Broadway and you see a show and you're like, well, how did that make it?
Yeah. And the answer is someone had money and decided that it ought to be there. And there was a theater available and they said, sure. You know, it's just all about the people that hold the keys, which is all about money. No one produces theater on Broadway just for fun or just for, you know, because they think it ought to be on Broadway. I mean, very rarely. Like, I'm pretty sure that the people that brought Spring Awakening to Broadway were pretty confident that they weren't going to make their money back because it was a limited run and it was a pretty niche thing. You know, the original production, which was a huge phenomenon, I think only barely just recouped it. The economics of Broadway are so ridiculous. So that was a rare instance, I think, where someone just really believed in something and thought it ought to be on the world stage.
So is your Muppet team going to come back and do something else, do you think?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, me and my husband, Michael, are always sort of like dreaming up productions and dreaming up interesting ways that we can crack something open and mess it up and think of it in a new way. I would love to do that again with the people that we did Spring Awakening with, because it was just the most joyous time But he's continuing to do that all the time. He's got a show on Broadway right now, Once on This Island, which just won Best Revival Tony, another show that he really turned on its head. If you were familiar with the original production, he really found a way in that changes everything. It's sort of his specialty, so it's cool to be a part of.
Well, the book is great fun, and I hope you, hopefully you're having great fun continuing it.
Yes, very much so. Thank you.
Andy Mantis's new novel is The Backstagers and the Ghostlight. It is published by Amulet Books from Abrams Books. Andy, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great pleasure. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Thanks to Argo Studios and Paul Ruess for their production assistance. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.